Well, thank you. I failed to mention one thing. We've also added 100 of the largest cities on top of the 150 regions. This actually, Manuel Pastor is a professor at the University of Southern California, and he runs something like called PEER, the Partnership for Environmental and Regional Equity. Manuel Pastor and I, when President Obama got elected, were invited to the White House to talk about issues of opportunity and inclusion. And it was a small meeting, only about 20 people there, but the meeting got framed up by a few people who were extremely well-meaning, but were not willing to talk about race, were not talking about the issues with the kind of urgency and a storyline to inspire you to address it. Manuel and I went out afterwards and we sat down and we talked and we said, we need to not just be attending these meetings, raising these issues from the audience and trying to shift the conversation. We need to start pulling together a story, including data, about what is really going on. And we decided we would do it. His is mostly a research shop. Ours is mostly a policy advocacy communication shop. We do research, he does policy advocacy and communications, but we're talking about what we were leading with. We said, we've got a president now who wants to talk about these issues. We don't have forever for one of our organizations to become everything. We need to join forces. We went and we met with the then president of the Ford Foundation, Luis Zubinas, and we told him what we wanted to do. And they gave us resources, and we started building it. And it's one of the things that we are just so proud of, not because it's so useful, but because we modeled being able to collaborate. And so we did it together. Thank you for asking. Was I just calling anyone? Could you raise your hand so I know who's talking? Oh, hi. I can hear you.
Hi, I have a really quick question. The initial video you showed was powerful. First question, where could I find it, and how did you come about making it?
You can get it, right. Will you send it to people who are here?
Sure, okay. We'll put it up on our website.
Terrific, thank you. We wanted to start off our summit by helping people to understand they're not going to see another moment like this one. This is the message we take every place we go, but it's one thing to say it, it's another to see it. And so we worked with a producer, and the producer found that very talented spoken word artist, and we talked about all the issues we thought needed to be included. So that's what we did. We said we want it to be about this is our moment. We think these are the things you ought to include. And then the creative juices just flowed from them, and of course there was some back and forth, but that's how we did it, and I love it. I'm glad that you did too.
I'm going to turn it over to Nathaniel Smith, who's moderating this panel. Thank you.
So let's give Angela Glover Blackwell another round of applause.
Thank you.
So just a slight secret, you know, Angela has been working diligently for a number of years, and she has been an inspiration for so many people. We hear a lot from her about the things that need to be done and the various policy solutions that need to be elevated in order to make our communities better. But one of the things that she cannot say, and as someone who is moderating this discussion, I can take the privilege of saying, is that she has played a part in elevating, inspiring, and really positioning the next generation of equity leaders around this country. And so for that, I honor you for that,
thank
Angela,
you.
And I want to give you a personal elevation for that. For those that may not know me, my name is Nathaniel Smith, and I serve as founder and chief equity officer of an organization called the Partnership for Southern Equity. We focus on elevating a new Southern agenda for balanced growth and shared prosperity in the American South. We're based in Atlanta. A lot of our work is in Atlanta. And through our partners, some of them on this stage, we have had an opportunity to elevate the issues of equity and inclusion. And we consider GPBI, of course, a valuable partner in moving the equity agenda forward in Georgia. And I want to honor GBBI, too, for having an awesome conference and their leader, Tafia, for doing such an awesome job. Thank you so much. So let's get down to the, like some folks used to say, Angela, to get down, right? We've had an opportunity to hear about many of the challenges that we face in our state associated with the many barriers around economic opportunity and economic inclusion. We've also heard from great leaders like Angela and others that we cannot move forward as a state, as a region, leaving our emerging majority behind. We've seen the data. Mike Carnathan has done an awesome job in articulating the data around where those particular barriers are. And we've also heard a lot about the various programs and efforts, so to speak, that have been elevated in order to minimize the burden, Alicia, of some of the challenges that we're facing in our state and in our region. But there's one fact, one issue that we have not had a chance to talk about, and this is why we're on the panel today, and that are those are the structural impediments to the success of our most vulnerable populations, and in particular in the American South. We are in a very unique environment, an environment that actually strengthened its economy, jump-started its economy off of the backs of wageless labor. We have to acknowledge that. We have to acknowledge that our economy grew as a result of employees that were not paid. And the system was created to minimize opportunities for those communities for generations. And here we are in a place now where we actually have to turn to those generations that have been left behind and build them up in a way that they can finally contribute to our economy. So the sins of the past, if we're not committed to alleviating them, will minimize our ability to be successful in a global economy. So I wanted to make sure that I laid it out. And every person on this panel is playing a critical role in removing the barriers nationally and locally that minimize the opportunities for our most valuable and yet most vulnerable populations to be involved in our emerging and current economy. And so let me start by introducing our panelists. Of course, Ms. Angela Glover Blackwell, founder and CEO of PolicyLink. We also have Ms. Janelle Williams, who is with the Annie Casey Foundation Civic Site. We have Alicia Phillip, who is another institution in itself in terms of the work that she has done in Atlanta, leading the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. And of course, Mr. Zam Zimmerippa, who now leads Zimmerippa Capital Incorporated, a past legislator, policy champion, progressive voice. Please give him a round of applause for coming and participating. So I wanted to actually segue our conversation in a historical way, Angela, and I really wanted to start with you because I think the way that you ended it also provides us an opportunity, a contextual opportunity to begin our conversation anew around the structural impediments. You are engaged in a national movement. You are a leader of a national movement to really alleviate some of the structural barriers of economic opportunity. From your perspective, why is the South in particular so important and critical to this conversation? Of course, there are inequities and other challenges all around the country, but it seems as if recently philanthropy and others have began to look towards the South and look at the South for the various challenges and opportunities that we present. In your opinion, why do you feel or do you see the South as an important component of elevating this equity agenda?
I certainly do see it as important, and I certainly have seen that it's gotten more attention recently, particularly from philanthropy. I have been in many philanthropic discussions now. What about the South? I think part of that conversation has to do with, as we look at the nation's shifting demographics, and the Latino population is really at the leading edge in terms of the shifting demographics. There is this conversation, but what about African Americans? And when you think about African Americans, you think about the South, and the South is one of the places where we're seeing a growing Latino population. So as you turn to the South, it's all right there in front of you. There are also a lot of Native Americans in the South, and very often, because it's so hard to get the Native American data, we leave them out of the conversation, and on the indicators, they often are at the very bottom. The incarceration rates, all of those things. So I think that's part of it. I also think that Raj Chetty's work, that work on economic mobility has said a lot, as it's just a swath through the South where you're seeing the least amount of economic mobility, and the South is a very important part of the nation. So it's big, there are a lot of people who live there. It has a particular problem in that it's suffering both because of the legacy of racism and discrimination, because of the legacy of the absence of organized labor. Those two things have put it in a perilous position, because so long as jobs are not paying good wages, and so long as the racial segregation continues here, two things that we know are going to contribute to not being effective in the future, people are wondering, well, how are we going to overcome these issues?
Thank you, Angela. And so if you marry kind of the historical challenges that have brought us to this point in terms of our economic competitiveness as the American South, mm-hmm. and marry that with the talk that you gave around the solutions and some of the other entrenched challenges that we face, I wanted to actually take a step back and give the panelists an opportunity to just provide their own reflection or thoughts about Angela's presentation. And provide from your particular perspective, of course, philanthropy, capital, your perspective not only of just what you thought, I mean, just as, and also
and
how do you want to engage?
And yeah. I might also end it with
sure,
a question.
Sure, that'd be great. That'd be great. That'd be great.
Is that okay?
That'd be great. That'd be excellent. And we can start with you, Alicia, if you don't mind.
You know me.
We can start
like on
with
the
you.
Edge of my chair, okay? You know? I think I was most taken by all the research that's been done about that inequality is bad for growth. Mm-hmm. And those of us who've been in Atlanta a long time know that there's nothing Atlanta likes more than to grow. I mean, it's like mm-hmm. our number one
yep.
sport
yep.
is growing.
Yep, yep, it is.
So therefore, why are we not able to tie that case and to really get more people on board with understanding that? And that's where I keep coming back to. Is it the messengers that are wrong? Are we not framing the message correctly? I keep coming back to this because I can't quite grasp why we can't take that message in a town that cares about nothing more than growth. I mean, do you have any thoughts about that, about why that message doesn't resonate everywhere?
I'm sure my answer is inadequate, because that is the fundamental question. But this is a new conversation. I mean, up until very recently, the conventional wisdom among economists was that inequality is good for growth. Mm-hmm. I mean, that really was it. I mean, it's really just been in the past, I'd say, 5 or 6 years that this has emerged, and that it's emerged with data. And it took Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz a while to start saying that. I'd say that they both only started saying it in the past 4 years, and they are the progressive economists. So one part of the answer, it's a new story, and being able to tell that story with data is an emerging thing. And so, you know, it always takes a while for people
right.
to catch on. I also think that the work we did on the National Equity Atlas, actually showing the benefit to the GDP, that's new. Brookings Institute is picking up on that kind of thing now, but that's new. So we're just in the early part of case making. And then there are so many cultural things about the entire nation that fight against logic.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's just true. So you got logic, and then you've got all this cultural
right.
baggage. And so it's going to take a while, but all of us who start hearing this have to keep saying it. We have to just keep saying it over and over again and demonstrating it.
Yeah,
and writing op-eds and
yeah.
writing pieces and stuff, because I think the more we have different kinds of messengers
mm-hmm.
saying that message, and chambers of commerce people
That's
and
right.
other people in addition, you know, I'm saying that message, because I think that is the compelling, you know, I always want to latch one to one thing, but I think that's a very compelling message.
You know, Alicia,
since
we're at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute meeting, I think it's your question is the right one. all suffering is local, but all tax policy is in Washington.
Good point.
And in reality, Georgia is not a real island that is unique, because we all live and breathe with the same policy that influences the same financial system we have here, the same corporate system we have here, the same franchise systems we have here, the same place everywhere else except Alabama. That's a joke.
Oh,
Alabama
okay.
is very unique. The issue, my reaction, Angela, and by the way, I listened to your other presentations, and thanks for what you're doing on tape. It is the time. It is always the time. There is never a moment when it isn't the time. And what I like about what you're doing is you're showing the proof points of where the time, how that makes sense. But the time is always here, and the question is what is your fight? What is your fight? And I don't think one fight fits all. I think we all can fight in very different ways. I saw Hattie Dorsey here earlier. I think she walked out. But I remember fighting with her and Maynard Jackson. And then I remember the different kind of fight with Andrew Young, very different kinds of fights. And so you can choose your fight. I personally I learned when I was in the Senate, Hattie, I just said your name, and you walked out.
There she is.
I learned in the Senate that what I thought should happen was not achievable. That's the first lesson I learned. And I learned in order to achieve what I wanted, I had to have partners that I did not like. And I mean, really. Mm-hmm. I didn't like them so much I've even forgotten their names. Mm-hmm. But that lesson has stuck with me. And I think it's a lesson that all of us need to be mindful of, is that we will not accomplish anything in the company of the familiar. We will accomplish things with strangers, with people that we are not comfortable with. And part of the problem that we have in describing the equity argument, and I'm with a foundation, I'm a trustee in a foundation that has a lot vested in that argument, is that that argument really only resonates with certain people. It just doesn't resonate with many people, a lot of other people. And so the question, I think the challenge for progressives, and that's the word I would use for who we are here, is people trying to think about things, is what is it that you can bring to the table that brings strangers? What is it that you can bring to the table that brings people that don't agree with you? And how far can you get with that? Whatever that is. And I think that's the big problem. And I'd like to just do a segue for a moment, if I could, about this concept of meaningless work or dead-end work or dead-end jobs or living wage, even for that matter. I don't think we've seen the best economic thinking yet. I don't think we have seen the best and the brightest show up yet to tell us what our economy should look like. I don't think a 20th century ideal is where we should be. I think we should be in an ideal that we haven't defined yet, that's a little bigger and a little bit more interesting about the reality of what's in front of us. And the reality is global, and the reality is franchises, and the reality is highly educated people, and the reality is that still somebody has to change our bed in a hotel. Somebody has to cook for us in a fast food restaurant. Somebody has to turn our parents late at night in a personal care home. So all of those realities give us a different view of what our economy really is, not how we romanticize it. And I think in my challenge to anyone here is to think a lot more broadly about what that looks like and feels like. And since we're at GPVI, we're really here to talk about policy and taxes. Mm-hmm. And that really is where the heart of this thing comes down. This is not a fight in the street. This is going to be a fight in the U.S. Congress.
Thank you.
Nathaniel, could I respond to the first part
of
that?
Sure.
Because the second part of what you said, I think I probably agree with, because I do think that there, the jobs that you described that will always be there will always be there. And I think the morning panel was very good in saying, but those don't have to be jobs that don't allow people to live with dignity. We need to be able to raise the floor so that those jobs can be good jobs. Ai-Jen Poo has written a wonderful book talking about the relationship with people who are doing home care work and people who are elderly and how much they have in common. Mm-hmm. But the first part of what you said, I also agree with, but I wanted to nuance it a little bit. It is certainly true that we will not get the change that we want if we talk to each other. We have to bring in new people. We have to find uncommon ground. But we have to have an organized movement for change. And to have the organized movement for change, people have to be able to define the struggle in ways that resonate with them, which is why I find it so important to call out race, to call out what's going on in communities, to call out for the people who have skin in the game, because progressives are always talking about wanting to have good education policy, wanting to have good economic policy, wanting to have good housing policy, and yet, very often, those are people who live in very nice neighborhoods, who kids go to very nice schools, who have very nice jobs. But the people who are dependent on public schools for their children getting an education, people who are dependent on a living wage job, people who are dependent on affordable housing, often don't see themselves in the conversation. And when they see themselves in the conversation and you get their energy, then you got the kind of movement that we're talking about. So I agree with you, but there's a piece that comes before that.
I hear you, sister.
That.
I am all with you. So I am.
So very good, very good. So from what we've heard, it takes a sophisticated communication apparatus in order to really sell the equity agenda mm-hmm. to people that may not necessarily be completely open to it. It takes a sophistication around policy and budgeting and being able to work with uncommon allies. But it also takes the ability to really build power with like-minded people around an issue in a way that will hold the decision makers accountable. Mm-hmm. And so with those three kind of pillars of change, what is the role of philanthropy in playing a role in actually creating that type of scaffolding or ecosystem for the type of change that we want to see? I mean, we can honestly say here in Georgia and in metropolitan Atlanta in particular, that our civic bench is very shallow. To put it nicely, we don't have a lot of organizations that are doing the type of stuff that we've been talking about. And unfortunately, for the organizations that are doing this work, they're not really being funded, right? At the level that they need to be funded in order to really push against the type of status quo challenges that we're facing in the community. Alicia, Janelle, does philanthropy have a role in this?
I'm going to let Janelle go because she hasn't spoken.
Absolutely, philanthropy has a role in this work. I think it's really critical to be clear about our role and to be really clear about the rules of engagement within philanthropy and understanding that philanthropy covers a very broad spectrum. We have corporate foundations, family foundations, and so their responsibility and the way they are charged to really deploy very responsible grant making looks different. So I think really it's a conversation about what is philanthropy's role in partnership with community? Because fundamentally, community has to drive the solutions they want to see.
Yeah.
And unless that power unless the conversation around power dynamics is really clear and open on the table, then philanthropy can engage in charitable investments, but it will not engage in structural change, mm-hmm. which is what we need. Thank you, Taifa. So I think it's really important for us to think about grant making in partnership with community, because when they do become isolated, it can be paternalistic at best. In a couple of instances, what we're doing with the Annie E. Casey Foundation, we're so excited. I feel so thankful every day to be part of a foundation that really is courageous enough and committed enough to call out racial equity as an explicit goal. And we say this because our mission is tied to ensuring all children secure a bright future. Well, if when we look at the data, we see that children of color communities of color are disproportionately impacted and locked out of opportunities, then we have a commitment to support those communities. So with that being said, we're really excited about the opportunity moment to work with diverse partners, to work with partners like the Chamber of Commerce and GBPI on a workforce policy agenda. We think this is an opportunity moment to do business differently, and philanthropy is responsible for helping to chart that course at the community's request.
Thank you. Alicia?
I think one thing to really keep in mind about philanthropy, particularly in the South, is that philanthropy is people. It's not major institutional philanthropy. I mean, that's a relatively small piece of philanthropy. Mm-hmm. It's really governed, even if they are foundations, they are led by the founder. Mm-hmm. And it's very, you know, it's very people-driven. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think that the key in philanthropy in the South is to get philanthropists really engaged with communities. And it comes back to exactly what you said, is to break down that barrier between the two. And I'm so heartened. I mean, I've been doing this for 38 years, but I am so heartened by the number of individual donors who now are saying to me, and these are people with a fair amount of, you know, with wealth, who are saying, we've got to do something. We've got to do something like getting money in the hands of poor people, because they're going to, you know, they're going to spend it. It really will help the economy anyway. You know, there's an economic argument for it. Or we've got to make a difference about the opportunity infrastructure. We have a whole group of donors who are have been coming together for a year, talking about what their role can be in looking at how they can utilize their dollars in funding things along the opportunity infrastructure. This is new. I have not seen this from, particularly, they're mostly white, you know, wealthy donors who are saying, enough is enough. Mm-hmm. I want to be part of the solution.
Mm-hmm. And that's wonderful. And Sam, of course, there's a role for the private sector to play, of course.
Well, let me get my couple of hats on here, all right?
Okay.
You've got a lot. I got a couple of sombreros on, baby. You know, I am a trustee to a big philanthropy, a big one, and it does great work. But let me just say that the first thing you discover if you're a trustee to a foundation is you discover how little money you have. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have $3 billion. If you add it all up, and I'm not cynical about philanthropy, I think that what's been said is exactly right. But if you add it all up, at least I think the figure nationally is we give away about $57 billion. McDonald's cap is $108 billion. Starbucks is $87 billion. Apple is $667 billion. On a relative basis, the philanthropy, all the excitement about philanthropy is warranted, but we have to understand it in relative terms. And so what I would say is, to Janelle's point, well said, philanthropy has to have a partner. Without a partner, it's fishing. Yeah. And I think that's been one of the great things. After all, it is called the Community Foundation, right? And that institution is about the community it's in. But I think any organization that's trying to achieve outcomes has got to be vested in their community. And some foundations, I wouldn't criticize any of them. I just think that people giving away money trying to do things is extraordinary. I don't even know how to explain how that happened. Mm-hmm. But the foundations that do the best jobs, I think, are the ones that do get in the trenches. And they're the ones that are willing to make big bets. And sometimes it takes them a long time. It's very slow. But I think it's exactly as Janelle said. Mm-hmm. You build a community partner.
And so let's put on the other sombrero that you wear. Your words.
You mean the one with the guns?
Yeah, the one with the guns. So you know, Alicia talked about, you know, how do we communicate this conversation to the uncommon?
I want to say that I'm willing to go to the street with Angela. I'm willing to sign up and work for Angela tomorrow. I'll follow you. I'll go with you. You don't have to do anything.
I'll take you.
I'll go with you. But I'm going to just double down here and say that we have not done any new thinking of any magnitude about the nature of these problems. We just haven't. Most of us are on one side or the other. You know, we can size one another up with our rhetoric really quickly. It doesn't take long to know what side you're on when you see that video. And I can tell you, a lot of people I know would have shut down on that video, even though I liked it. Why don't they like what I like? So part of the problem is a creative problem, Angela. It's a creative problem. It's not just an immoral problem. It's a creative problem. How do we talk about this in ways that matters?
How do we?
I will tell you my failed attempt.
Okay.
I will give you a great failed example.
A great failed example.
Yes. Failure has got to be a part of it. I mean, look, if you look at failure philanthropy, they don't tell you about that part.
I'll
tell you about the part. It doesn't work. You know, several years ago, I was under the gun in the General Assembly to get something going on the immigration issue in the Georgia General Assembly. Quite frankly, that was impossible then, and it's impossible now. But what I thought was, if I could figure out a way to build a bigger tent, to make it simple, and to talk about it in a way without using the incendiary language, because the language is so awful. It's so awful. If I could just figure out a way to talk about it, that maybe I could build a bigger tent. And I got some Republican friends of mine to do that. And we started something called the Essential Economy. And the Essential Economy was a simple concept. And that is, there are a range of jobs out there that are absolutely essential to the way we live. They're not bad jobs. They're essential jobs. Somebody has to turn your mother at night. Somebody has to make the bed. Somebody has to cook the meal. It's essential to the way we live. We can't live without it. And so I said, let's take an economic perspective. And the long story short, we spent a bunch of money, and we figured out that in Georgia, and by the way, there are only 4 million people that work in the state of Georgia. Out of the 10 million people that live here, 4 million people work. And of that 4 million people, 25% of them work in what we call the essential economy. And that's an economy, are you ready, where you don't have to have a credential. And everybody in this room, by the way, has one, I think. Or at least they say they do. In the essential economy, there's no barrier to entry. There's no credential. You can show up tomorrow and have the job. And in Georgia, there are 1 million of those jobs on the average that pay $21,000 a year, that contribute $114 million in taxes, in sales tax every year, and it's $49 billion of economic value in the state, which is only about 10% of the GDP. That's what we found out. But the point was this. The point was this. We can't live without it. We have to have it. We depend on it. So the question is, if it's important to us, if it's essential to me and you, and if it's essential to our neighbors and to Republicans too, then why can't it be more sustainable? Why? And that was the basis for a lot of conversations that I think are interesting. Now, it failed because I went back to business. Because I said, I'm going to go back and do my work now and take care of what's essential for Sam. But I don't think it's a bad example. I think it's a good example of trying to say, in the future, we're going to have essential economy workers. We're going to have them. And what does that look like? And what should it look like? And how do we define that in a way that's meaningful? And I'll give you one example, then I'll stop, because Alan's sitting out there. He's jumping at the bit. It's this simple. It's a tax policy. It has to do with the fact that the wages are taxed at a level that is unsustainable. And you got to take that tax policy and you got to reverse it for the what's called the low wage earners. You got to flip it. And you got to give those you got to give that money back to those people and let them have it, and you have to sustain those jobs. And I'll say one more thing. My friend A.D. Frazier, who's a big capitalist, I had a lot of conversations with him about this. He said, "Sam, what you're missing here is you just don't have a way to make this manageable." He said, you need a LEED certification for this kind of thing. If you're going to make it work in business, you need to have a LEED certification. And I'll end on this, Angela. We don't have the business partners we need to create a certification for what is a sustainable essential economy. We don't have those partners. And the reason we don't have those partners is because we just don't have a way to get them to the table. And if we had them, I think we could get a little, some distance. But the reality is that the interesting thing about the essential economy concept was that it was describing something that's here, that's going to be here for the foreseeable future. But it was a good way of talking about the work. It's a good way. The work is essential. It is important work. None of us out here would want our children to work in a dead-end job or in a low-wage job. We don't aspire to those things. But we could aspire to working in an essential economy where what we do is important. And I think that's a values construct. And so that's kind of an example of what I'm saying. And there you have it.
Thank you. And so, you know, one of the points that you made, which I think is very valuable, is the need for innovation.
Correct.
As you think about economic opportunity. What I will add to that, though, is that I do believe that there are people that think a great deal about our economic circumstances in our state, and those are the people that are suffering because they have no choice but to think about the challenges that they face every day. What I want to propose, and I'm really looking at you, Janelle, because I know you recently did a report for the city of Atlanta called Changing the Eyes, and we had the honor of really playing a part in that, is how do we move away from depending on the usual suspects and not just the folks that may not be open to this conversation, but the communities that are hungry for change, the organizations that are connected to these communities. How do we begin the process of creating the type of community of engagement that we need in order to move the work forward without Sam constantly, I think what we depended on a lot in Atlanta and the state are our relationships. We haven't done a lot around putting pressure on policymakers from an advocacy perspective because we don't have that ecosystem in place. And so how do we begin the process of building that so more people can get involved in this conversation other than the policy elites like us who sit around and have this type of conversation all the time?
I mean, it's a complex process. I just want to lift up some highlights for the report. We don't have copies here today, but feel free to access the report at www.aecf.org. The report is titled, The Race for Results in Atlanta, Changing the Odds. And so just a couple of highlights around why this really accelerated our priority to focus on leveling the play field in Atlanta. I just want to leave you with a couple of data points which informed who was part of the, and still we're forming our partnership base to change those odds. One in five African-American children in Atlanta live in an opportunity-rich community. Angela shared that where we live strongly correlates with life expectancy, quality of education. So one in five African-American children in our city live in an opportunity-rich community. Okay, that was one thing that was very striking for us. Another data point that was really striking, median household income for white families in this city is $85,000 compared to median household income for African-American families, which is at $26,000. So we're looking at rates not 1.5 times or 2 times, but 3 times and higher. Okay, when we look at education, last year, 2014, Atlanta Public School graduates, we had 84% of white students graduate high school on time. The data reflected 54% for African-American students, 57% for Latino students. So if we want to really develop a competitive, vibrant community and economy, we need to make sure that children, families, and communities that are locked out have access. So part of our work is really to think about who are the key players that could change the game. And so, of course, we rely heavily on community residents to really tell us this story, to tell us around what's your experience getting from, you know, Mechanicsville to 400, right? What is that commute like when you have to drop off your daughter along the way? I tell people all the time, I'm a mom of a four-year-old. My husband and I have vehicles, and we always have to negotiate with each other around who gets the burden of drop off and pick up to navigate Atlanta traffic. I have to cook dinner tonight. That's real, because he did drop off. And so I can't begin to think about, you know, what this means for a single or two-parent home that has to do a 2.5-hour commute. So we constantly are trying to hear from community residents what is their story. We have some investments in community investment fund grants where, again, this is around supporting community residents to take ownership of their issues. But it's also challenged us around the policy space to really work with diverse partners. I reference our work we're doing with Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce and GBPI, and some of the things we're collaborating on is to really take advantage of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. This was passed in 2014, and we think that this piece of policy could truly be a game changer if it is implemented right, if it has a key priority on equity. I mean, now we have the opportunity to really not just scream who has access to much needed employment and training dollars. We could actually support families that are deep in need in a responsible way. So we're thinking about how do we support policy that supports career pathways, on-ramps to economic opportunity, if you will. And that's really important. The other pieces of work I think is important is what's emerging around anchors. And I see Federal Reserve Bank in the room, Atlanta Regional Commission in the room. I mean, how do we leverage anchors as core tenants of our city? I mean, we are home to major universities and hospitals in the metro area. And so there's a lot of research done on the procurement practices of anchor institutions and how they can support our mid-sized economy, our local economy. And so we're excited about work in the Atlanta Aerotropolis Alliance, if you will, and what it means so that Southside residents can get training support services that emerge from those industry clusters. So we think it's important to engage community on all spectrum, right? From our residents, from that mom that has to make that 2.5-hour commute and understand what that means in real life, to also chambers of commerce, to also our policy advocates, us leaning on strong research and data to make some responsible decisions. And it's a growing process and it's a learning process, but we're charged to embrace the vulnerability if we want to change the odds and do business differently.
Thanks, Janelle. And I couldn't think of a better segue for you, Alicia, in terms of the work that I know the Community Foundation is doing around leveraging anchors and really beginning the process of creating economic opportunity for communities through not a nonprofit business, I mean, but a for-profit business. You want to talk a little bit about that?
We're in the process of standing up a for-profit business that will be located in the Mechanicsville community that aeroponically will grow 1.5 million pounds of lettuce a year when we already have MOUs with the anchor institutions to purchase the lettuce. And the key to it really is, to me, is the 25 wealth-building jobs that will be created in this business. Mm-hmm. Because they will start out making living wage plus health benefits. And over time, they will actually own the business. There will be a stock purchase opportunity for the employees to actually build wealth. And we will be open to people who have criminal records and other things that normally would keep them from being employees. And it's modeled after some work that had been done in Cleveland. And we really felt like it was important to try to do it here in Atlanta. And this, hopefully, if this is successful, this will be the first business of many that can be located in low-income communities so that people can walk to work. We won't have the transportation issue. They can hire, you know, first from right around the business so that people can just, you know, really easy access to work. And we could do businesses like this in many other parts of the metropolitan area in pockets where there is real need. Because And the donors who supported the startup of this, $800,000 came from donors who had donor-advised funds at the Community Foundation. That's the money that was used to start it. And most all of them were entrepreneurial-type people who said, we've just got to do things differently. Mm-hmm. We can't keep doing the same things and thinking we're going to get different answers. And so they were willing to, in essence, roll the dice to try to make this work to see if something could be, if this could be one different model. It's not the panacea for everything. I'm not saying that. But we got to keep finding different ways. And, you know, another one that I was going to mention is the bold, bold move of the Whitehead Foundation in giving $20 million to stand up Achieve Atlanta, which has as its goal getting kids ready for college while they're in Atlanta Public School High School by having counselors in every school dedicated to college counseling, summer bridge program, last dollar scholarship for post-secondary, so it's college technical, I mean it's 4-year, 2-year, counseling when they're in college to help them stay in college, and emergency money while they're in college to try to double the number of students who start ninth grade at APS that actually graduate from some post-secondary, because that's got to change. You heard the numbers that you were saying about, what is it, 42%?
42%.
And that has to be different. There have to be more people who have needs, actually be able to get through school and be able to compete for those jobs. So I do think philanthropy has a role in trying things that are different. And they're not always going to be large scale enough, wish that it would in every county, it wasn't just for APS or it's one business, it's not my neighborhood, but philanthropy can begin things that then hopefully can multiply too.
So, we've tried our best as folks that do the best we can around this issue. To really talk about some of the structural challenges that we face in moving our state forward, moving the nation forward to become a more just and inclusive, not only society, but also within that, a more just and inclusive and lucrative economy. And through that, hopefully you've heard some real examples of things that really could be done and the components and the ingredients that are needed to make the gumbo of economic inclusion that we need in order to feed everybody. What I wanted to do was stop now, if you don't mind, Taifa, and give folks an opportunity to ask any questions they may have. I don't know where the microphones
the mic right
are. Okay. Any questions?
That's okay. I don't drink water. You don't?
No. Starting to hear it on more.
Hi, I had one question. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name, female to the right.
Alicia.
Yes. Alicia.
In reference to the funding for counselors to really support students in making it to college and successfully making it through college, is there also in that same funding additional money so that, yes, definitely have the counselors that are addressing that issue. I think that's very much needed. But the reality is for a lot of inner city, or sometimes not even inner city, just for a lot of children, there are other issues that counseling is needed for to even get them to the point where college can be their goal and priority.
And that's not the direct thing of Achieve Atlanta, but one of the things that it does is by having a college counselor dedicated to college counseling, it actually frees up the other counseling resources of the high school to be able to deal with some of those other issues. And those are, the counselors within high schools are trained, counselors. And these are trained around college counseling. So you begin to really free up those people to do that other kind of counseling. And, it's also not through this program, but they're really trying to build, APS is trying to build out a much more robust relationship with nonprofit organizations that can have that connection to really helping students in addition to the services the school system can provide. So, sometimes, though, you got to be clear about what you can do and what you can't do. And one program can't sort of do everything, but it's got to know that those other pieces, like you're saying, are happening. for it to be successful.
Well said.
Hi, I'm Dr. Angelica Jeter, and I'm from the Satchel Health Leadership Institute of Morehouse School of Medicine. And in listening to the conversation, I wanted to say thank you to all of the panelists for what you had to say today. But one of my concerns about getting creative when it comes to policy change is that we're faced with a situation in living in the South and living in Georgia that we're always having to find new ways to say the same thing. And we never address the issue.
Yep.
And so one of the things that we are constantly taught at the Satcher Institute, especially by
Dr. Satcher.
Dr. Satcher and
I know him well.
Our colleague Kamora Jones, is to name racism and discrimination for what it is, and to identify those things as part of the structural barriers of why we're having this conversation. And something that I don't hear from a lot of people is giving examples of how they got around that and still addressing and naming what the real issues are. And so it would be wonderful to hear some examples of how people did that instead of finding different ways to talk about the new things, but still addressing the problems and the issues that were faced in our communities.
So I'll start, and actually I'm gonna pass the ball off to Janelle as well with the Changing the Odds report and the work that Casey is doing around racial equity and inclusion. And I'll just give one example specifically about the work that the Partnership for Southern Equity is doing around transportation equity. We're very, very, and many people know, very unapologetic about the importance of racial equity as it pertains to regional growth. And when we began the process of really moving a transportation equity agenda in Metro Atlanta, and we were successful in Clayton County in expanding public transit, we led with a racial equity agenda. And they're being very, very clear that the disparities that we see in transportation in our region are economic to a certain extent, but that economics is influenced by a lens of structural racism that perpetuates itself through public policy. So that gave us an opportunity to really go into a community and other communities and galvanize uncommon allies and folks that need to be heard around this issue of not just mobility, but also access, right? So that's one example. And to carry on that, in the next shameless plug, in the next few weeks, we'll actually be coming out with a report called Opportunity Deferred, the History of Race and Transportation in Metro Atlanta, which will really begin the process of talking about the racial challenges that we faced, and not just how it has affected communities of color, but how, because we don't have a comprehensive transportation system, everybody has to sit in traffic, right? Everybody has to deal with bad air. Everybody has issues around health problems and other challenges. So we're really excited about that, and I appreciate you lifting it up because I think we have to be willing to call a thing, and after we do that, create opportunities for people to come together to have a real conversation about it. Janelle, did you want to talk about
that? Yeah, just thank you for asking that question. Three quick points as I try to not get this to fall out. You know, fundamentally, we believe racial equity is critical. The way to really advance racial equity is not to make it a pet project or a special body of work, but to embed it in the way you do business. So it's not really if it's negotiable, it's how you do your work. So it's not a what, but it's a how. I think that's a really very important distinction to move in the needle. So it shows up through strategic investments around economic inclusion, because if they are done right, they will impact people of color, communities that have been left behind. And it does get to the shared results around racial equity. So that's one frame really wanted to lift up. The other piece is around data. And I think we still struggle around what we measure. You know, they say what we measure is what matters, but we really use metrics that lean exclusively on the language of personal responsibility. Right? We measure metrics that assess how well students performed, how well families are doing economically. But we really haven't looked at structural indicators are they really functioning the way they're designed to, or how can they be improved? And there's a need for innovation in how we measure success. Because if we do really become innovative on that front, then you know, there's a lot more value in terms of what Angela was saying, in terms of our common ground. There's a lot more shared beliefs. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, Nate mentioned it before, but the value of capacity building and training. This is really difficult work, and it's deeply personal. It's deeply personal. When you talk about issues of racial equity, you could leave a room enraged, overwhelmed, or very giddy. I went twice to the Center for Civil and Human Rights with my family over the holidays, and you know, my family was quite emotional. It was a, you know, this is very personal. And so how do you provide correct training and technical assistance so that people can get to the results in a responsible way that does not compromise or undermine their value add? That's so critical. And so, you know, would love to talk with you more in terms of how do you create a learning community built on pillars of sound training and TA so that the results isn't compromised because of, you know, the niceties of dancing around, you know, the challenges of politics and culture and all the complexities that come with it. But and thanks for your question.
I think one of the other things is, and I missed Mike's presentation this morning, but I have heard Mike's presentation a lot, is the investment that philanthropy and others have made in Neighborhood Nexus, that the data that Mike was using this morning and how important it is for us as a community to have one data set that we're all looking at with lots of 1,000 different variables in it, so that we're talking the same language. Data is data. We can then figure out how we want to use that data and the story we tell about that data and how we use it in our work. But having a solid, good, really important data for this community in common is really important to be able to tell, show that racial, I mean, to be able to see I-20 and to be able to see what I-20 looks like below, you know, the land below I-20 looks like. That's important. Those are important stories.
Angela, did you have anything?
I do, but I'm so enjoying the question. You're sure? So I'll just keep them coming.
Next person.
Hi, I'm Lisa Parsons. I do social justice work looking at ending the violence against women and girls, but that has to do with everything that we're talking about today, obviously. And some of the things that you said today were that we need new ways of message, we need a new way of thinking. There's so many things going on with this of a project that I would just like your opinions on. So art, when I saw a PBS special in the 60s and they were saying how the songs could mimic, you'd see a song come out that was about a certain thing and then the things kind of shifted and we just get it into our psyche. And so I think using art in these mediums is really important. And we started last year a project called Post for Peace and Justice, where we talk about community engagement. And so the point is to bring together a community of anything. So for a suggestion, we just put a proposal into the National Center for Civil and Human Rights on Black Lives Matter. So you bring in policemen, one segment of the society. How do they feel? How does it feel to be in fear all your life? You bring in the activists, you bring in the families who have lost someone, loved ones, you bring in the community where violence has happened or not happened. And you have conversations for them to make a piece of art that speaks and says what their voice wants to say. You pick quotes, you pick facts, you do art, and they actually paint them. You do it in each group, and then there's deep listening so that each of the groups there hear everybody else's perspective inside. And then together, the teams, people from each team come together to do one post with one voice to say what's the most important thing that they all have in common.
And interesting.
I just would like all of you to kind of be thinking of new ways to use art in a way that we can do some of these projects.
So I would like to comment on that. I love that comment because I believe it so much that when you think about the things that Sam and I have said, they may sound opposing, but they're part of the same thing. They're completely part of the same thing. And art is one of the only ways that we get to do that all at once. Art can hold what will appear to be conflicting ideas, conflicting ideas. It can hold things that seem to be in opposition. It can hold things that seem to be very different. And you can embrace the whole art piece. And it's so empowering to do that. At the summit that we had, and I'll be talking about the summit for at least 2 years, so just get ready for it. It was great, but also it was just, it took a year to put on. But not only did we start with the spoken word, but we had 60 sessions. 32 of them had poets that either at the beginning or at the end captured something. We had dance in the beginning. I don't know how many of you know Sarah Jones. She's an extraordinary artist. At the end, Sarah Jones performed. And I noticed that with the exception of the closing panel, which was about multiracial, multigenerational movement building, and people fell in love on that stage and they were embracing at the end, and it got a standing ovation. Other than that panel getting that standing ovation, the standing ovations were all for the art. And someone who was an artist and I were talking about that, and I said the reason for that is when people are talking as we're talking, people are moving into their camps. I agree with her, I agree with him, I agree with a third of that, I agree with two. But when the art happened, people could embrace the whole thing. And so it is so essential that we integrate art and culture into our work, not just in community development, but when we're having these conversations, because it's only then that we can see the whole.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Question for you all, but I want to pick up, Angela, when you first sat down on the stage, were telling us your story about how PolicyLink formed after your conversation with Obama. What I loved is you mentioned two of us left that room, sat down, and started thinking of a collaboration, went to a funder, and bam, the rest is history. So I'd love for you all to focus a little about what are you seeing and learning about what does it take to have good, effective collaborations? We've been hearing it for dozens of years from the philanthropy and everyone else. We can't do this alone. We need to collaborate. But I think we're all finding it's very complex to do collaborations. And it takes new skills, particularly who's got the skills to convene, to facilitate, and how, if we got 10 of us collaborating, the golden rule doesn't, whoever's got the most gold makes the rules. What can you advise us about where there's hopefulness about much more sophisticated collaboration practices here in addressing this issue?
Well, I could answer that, but I think that question is about those of you in Georgia, how you're collaborating.
Well, the phenomenal one I'll point out involves GBPI is the juvenile justice piece, where three organizations came together, and the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute was one of those, to rewrite the juvenile justice code. But what it took was the organizations really all having it as part of their strategic mission that this is something they wanted to accomplish. They weren't just randomly coming together or being put on a proposal because they needed a collaborating partner. They really had skin in the game. They put resources into the pot. Resources were added. But most importantly, someone was hired to be but the person who really sort of worked between the three organizations and worked with them and, sort of made things happen. And so I think those are all part of it, is some additional resources, but it's that shared vision, and it's the shared, it has to be part of what their organizations need to accomplish. That's my buttisons, using that one as an example.
And I do think collaboration is taking place in more authentic ways than it ever has.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it has to do with the urgency that I've been talking about. That once you decide you're going to solve the problem as opposed to just work on it, then you realize you can't do it alone.
Yes.
You can work on it by yourself, But if you're going to solve it, you have to work with others. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we're doing in everything we do is to say, what do you mean solve it? How many people are you talking about? What's the population-based result you want to get? Give me some numbers. Give me some faces. Disaggregate the data for me. And once you do that, then you understand who has to be in the partnership. Mm-hmm. And people understand what it means. That, you know, I'm so surprised the number of businesses. Listening to you talk, Sam, I was sitting here thinking about it. I have been so surprised at the number of big Fortune 500 businesses that keep inviting me to come and speak. And I pretty much say the same thing every place I go. And this is new for me, because for the most part, I have been speaking to people who were potentially in the choir. I wouldn't say I've been speaking to the choir, because you know, the choir is very small. But people who are potentially in the choir, the ones who usually ask me. But now businesses want to hear from me, and I think they want to hear from me because they're feeling the same thing I'm feeling. There's an economic imperative. Right. Something different is happening here. This woman is talking about it. Maybe she has something we want to hear. So I mean, once you decide you really want to solve the problem, you get a different kind of collaboration, and you're working together in a different way.
And the other thing that, just to add to what you were saying, Angela, that in order for real substantive collaborations to take place, the folks around the table have to be willing to give up power, a certain percentage of power, right? If you're not willing to give up something in order to benefit the whole, if you're not willing to give up your influence, because while people focus a lot on the dynamics of power outside of collaborations, there's just as much issue, there are just as many issues around power within collaborations, right? So you have to be willing to give up something in order to make the whole stronger. And that has been the challenge in the past, and in Atlanta in particular, is that you've had folks within collaborations that wanted to maintain their power. Mm-hmm. And not really give up anything in order to build a broader constituency of folks that can move the work forward. So, did we have one? Do we have time for one more? Okay. Hey, Neil.
Yeah. Thank you. Terrific comments by everybody. We've talked about economic equity, even transportation equity, family equity, a number of equity issues. How does all that translate into what is the, by my view, education equity? How is this woven into this so that we aren't just, to your point, Angela, pockets of work, but we're tying this together into education equity, which is the underpinning. All of you are very educated people, and you wouldn't be there if it weren't for that, and that's true if somebody said, others in this room. How do we create education equity in the context of the other equities?
One way, I think, is that we have to think of new ways of having parents be engaged and get communities engaged beyond just parents, but really get communities engaged in education. And the Community Foundation, we're looking at some new ways of doing that with our layering our neighborhood fund and that work together with work around the clusters of APS schools starting and seeing if we can really come at it differently. To get engagement for schools, because that's one of the real key pieces that's missing until you have those voices who can really talk about what's really happening and what's really important. It's people doing it to somebody else.
Right, right.
And so I think that's one of the real missing pieces in educational equity, in my opinion.
Another piece I'd add is really focusing on school climate rating. And I mean, the research continues to show that school climate is critical to student success. And when we disaggregate that data to look at how a school's composition interacts with a school's climate rating is really troubling. We see that schools with higher representation of minority students rate lower around the school climate rating. And so the state is doing a lot around the Get Georgia Reading campaign, and there's a lot of work, you know, more research being done about climate rating, but I think we need to, that there's something there that we need to really pay close attention to. What does it mean to really support a school that fosters an environment of learning? And this goes beyond warm and fuzzy feelings. This is really evidence-based research that shows us that children learn in schools where they feel encouraged to learn, right? Mm-hmm. What that means by teacher interaction, what does that mean in terms of administrative policies? So I think there's a lot of opportunity there around looking at our school climate rating, as well as quality early learning education.
Go ahead, Angela.
And I think it's so important to have a sense of urgency around the education agenda.
Yes.
A sense of urgency around that agenda because we know what to do. I traveled this entire country, every part of it, not every place in it, but every region within it. And I never go any place where people can't show me an island of excellence in terms of education. And I'm sure you could show it to me here in Atlanta. I've never been someplace where people wouldn't say, oh, I want you to come see this school or this classroom in this school. We know how to educate children. We're not feeling any sense of urgency about how to apply what we know to every child and to spend the money it takes to get there. Just take one thing, which is not the classroom, but it's something that we know. Middle and upper income families have been engaged in an experiment for decades that shows that being able to have enrichment programs in addition to what's happening in school in the summer,
right.
Violin lessons, dance lessons, debating, they pay for it. They pay for it because they know it's important, a part of the whole education process. We don't need to do a study to find out whether that'll make a difference for poor children. Middle-class families have shown that it makes a difference for all children. Mm. And so we need to understand how to apply what we know personally, what we know professionally, what we know from research. And the only thing that will cause us to do it is to embrace this sense of urgency. It is urgent, not just for the lives that are being lost. It is urgent for the nation.
I think it's important for us to see that all of the injury areas are connected. Criminal justice, economic opportunities, education,
yes, right.
Housing, and health care.
Right.
And this is a special moment. I came up through the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, so I remember when we were winning, you know, Civil Rights Act, Affirmative Action, Voting Rights Act, but changes can be changed back. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing now, which is so great to see the young people out. So the big question for us, when we move the structural barriers, how do we continue to advance and not fall back? And that's what we have to be thinking about, two generations removed from where I was back then. And so we see the school to prison pipeline. Now that's an education piece that has to be dealt with. And there is no public district that you could go in anywhere in this country and you can't see the overwhelming suspension of black boys. Mm-hmm. And now it's starting with black girls. Mm-hmm. So that's a real structural problem to be dealt with. And so I just want us to keep working together, keep working on it, and really understand what we're up against. Because institutional racism is alive and well.
Yes. Thank you. So
thank
two
you.
Quick things, and thank you so much for those comments. And I think one key point that you mentioned, which I think, again, is really, really important. You mentioned the Voting Rights Act. You mentioned the Civil Rights Act, Fair Housing Act as well, and other acts that happened. They were realized not because one day an elected official woke up and said, I want to do the right thing. Right. They happened because you had organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. You had organizations like SNCC. You had organizations like CORE. You had organizations like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and other organizations that were organizations that had leadership, that had infrastructure, that had support, that were connected to the community and understood their right as American citizens to ensure a strong participatory democracy. I mean, those are the things that we have to focus on as well is the role of democracy in making equity real and ensuring that institutions are in place that can help to move this work forward. So thank you for those comments. I wanted to end actually with a story, and I wanted to share with you this quick story. You know, my family, when we got together at the end of New Year's, we all sit around and have two watchwords as a family, you know, what are the things or the guiding words that we want to leverage going into the new year to inspire us to be better people and hopefully have a better 2016 versus 2015. And I had two watchwords actually that I want to share with you. One is courage. I hope and ask you all to stay courageous in the work that you do, whether it be small or whether it be large, whether you're nervous when you speak the truth, continue to be courageous in the work that you do, because courage is contagious. Mm-hmm. And as you continue to be courageous, other people will want to be courageous as well. And so I would just ask and hope that you remain courageous in your work. And second, and lastly, and definitely not least, continue to be hopeful. I know we've heard a lot of data today that was depressing about how Atlanta and Georgia has many, many problems. And sometimes it can make you feel a little down. But you're in this room right now. You participated in GBBI's summit because you have hope that you have the capacity, along with your friends and colleagues, to make real change happen in Georgia and in Metro Atlanta. And hold on to that hope, because without it, we're all in trouble. So I just wanted to leave you with those two words. Thank you so much for participating in this panel. And please, let's acknowledge our panelists for participating.
Thank you.